And the time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Coming up next on People Rise Up, conversations about various aspects of organic food, farming, and ranching. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA. You're also listening to us online at kboo.fm. My name is Andrew Geller, and today we're going to be talking about, in the first half of the show, recent changes made to how organic food is defined at the federal level. And in the second half of the program today, we'll be speaking about what organic farmers and ranchers can and are doing to promote biodiversity conservation. My guests for the first half of the show today are the director of the Organic Consumers Association, Ronnie Cummins, and the interim executive director of Oregon Tilth, John Foster. Now, what we're talking about here today is fallout late in the congressional session that resulted in a modification of the 1990 Organic Food Production Act. And before I get to my guests and ask questions about this, I just want to set a little bit of context, and you guys feel free to mention something that I didn't get right if I don't get something right here, because I'm trying to condense many years of activity into about a minute. So in the late 90s, the United States Department of Agriculture said, we're going to federalize the organic standard so we have a clear, consistent rule across the entire U.S. It generated a record number of public comments. A rule was made, and that rule allowed, there were three different categories of organic. There's the 100% USDA, there's 95%, and then there's the 70% threshold. Each of those are given different labels, and there's different things allowed based on the category. 100% organic is pretty straightforward, but the 95 allowed some non-organic substances in there that were approved in a separate process, something, and put on something called the national list. A blueberry farmer in Maine was not happy about that and said the new organic rule violated the 1990 Organic Food Production Act, sued in January this year. He won, and the synthetic ingredients were declared not to be okay in organic foods. And then the Organic Trade Association, which I guess has been a longtime advocate of all things organic, has kind of, well, maybe modified their stance based on some of its new members or more recent members, and a rider was put through on the 2006 Agriculture Appropriation Bill that changed that whole synthetics angle, as well as a couple of other things, but it's really the synthetics that I'm interested in speaking about. So with that, I'm going to bring Ronnie Cummins here into the mix, director of the Organic Consumers Association. Welcome to our airwaves.
Good to be with you.
Now, you folks, as well as many other organic food advocates, have been working on this issue at least for a couple of years, as far as I've been able to tell. Tell us just briefly, first, did I get that summary right enough for the listener?
Yes. I mean, the court case you spoke about, the Arthur Harvey lawsuit, which the court ruled on last June, it would have continued to allow the use of synthetic substances in made with organic products, that is, those that were between 70 and 95%.
And there were only about 35 or 38 synthetics on the national list. And, you know, I took a look at them, and a lot of it's stuff like baking soda, baking powder, lecithin, which is a soy derivative kind of used in emulsifying things, xanthan gum, you know, things that we all think of as pretty typically benign.
Yeah, I mean, what the point of contention was first of all, organic standards have always been decided by consensus in the organic community from the beginning. I mean, those of us involved in the co-op movement or the consumer movement or the farming movement, you know, we've spent 35 years developing this alternative food and farming system, which is now involved into a multi-billion dollar powerhouse and is becoming increasingly the dominant way of looking at the future of food and farming in this country, organics. So it's very important to the organic community that when we have changes in the standards, that we use the traditional consensus-building methods. And the Organic Trade Association, in this case, at the prodding of some of their larger members, in secret, went to Congress with modifications to the federal standards. They did not share those with other members of the organic community. The only way we actually got a chance to look at what we dubbed the sneak attack was because some congressional staff members basically gave us the document and said, look, what is this? The Organic Trade Association says that the organic community is behind this. And so the process was totally undemocratic. They hired some notorious public relations firms in Washington, D.C., like Covington and Burling, Lewis and Lesher. These are firms that represent companies like Monsanto and Philip Morris and Kraft and so on. And these are hardball players who get their way in a Republican-dominated Congress like what we've got today. And this is, from the standpoint of the organic community, this was a gross violation of trust. You don't play with the devil in order to get your way. So things started out on the wrong foot. The basic thing is that organic certification systems all over the world allow a limited number of synthetic substances to be used in organic production. For most of us in the organic community, it wasn't the fact that a few a few synthetic substances had been carefully reviewed by the National Organic Standards Board, our watchdog, over the last 10 years and approved 28 substances with 8 more to go on. The problem with this legislation is that it took away or diminished the review power of our traditional watchdog, the National Organic Standards Board, and instead put most of the power for reviewing synthetic substances in the hands of the White House-appointed U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has the legal power over a lot of organic standards, but we've also had to fight them, you know, in 3 major battles since 1997 when they first proposed federal rules for organics. So the organic community is quite familiar with the fact that USDA, left to themselves, tend to gravitate toward looser standards. I mean, what the big battle you mentioned when the standards first came into existence, the 280,000 letters, the USDA was preposterously proposing that genetic engineering, food irradiation, municipal sewage sludge, and other practices would be okay under the organic label. The community beat them back on that. We beat them back in 2003 when Congress had passed a sneak attack rider to the appropriations reconciliation bill that said you didn't have to use organic feed on an organic farm if it was too expensive. We beat them back on that. We beat them back in the summer of 2004 when the USDA arbitrarily said that certain previously prohibited pesticides and hormones and tainted animal feed would be allowed. Again,
so there's
mobilization, we beat them back. This time, however, it was an inside job. It was a sneak attack, and it hit right at the heart of the organic community's review power via our watchdog, the National Organic Standards Board, to review all synthetic substances.
Okay, and we'll come back to the issue of the emergency procedure provision, but I want to bring John Foster into the conversation here. He is the interim executive director of Oregon Tilth. They are based down in Salem, and they are an independent USDA-approved organic certifier and have been for many, many years. They also put out a publication called In Good Tilth. Welcome to the program to you, John.
Thanks very much.
Now, I'm curious, you're the interim director there, so you got more of an administrative role, but you told me yesterday that you have a lot of experience actually doing inspections. You were a certifier. You do a lot of technical analysis and writing on these issues. And I'm curious to hear how it has been for Oregon Tilth as a certifier to now have 5 years or so experience dealing with these new federal standards. Has it made things easier? Has it been more difficult? Problems you have now that you didn't have previously? Just a general sense.
Okay, let me just start with a little clarification that Oregon Tilth as a kind of an umbrella organization is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we operate actually multiple programs under that umbrella. Oregon Tilth Certified Organic is the certification program that is accredited by the USDA to operate and implement the National Organic Program. So our certification activities are just one aspect of what we do. And as an accredited certifier, we're pretty much bound by following the mandates of the NOP, or the National Organic Program, the staff, and by extension, certainly the USDA. So speaking in that position, it's had its ups and its downs, having a federalized program. But having been, I've been around organic industry for coming up on 15 or 16 years now, and so I've operated as an inspector, as a reviewer, and as an administrator in certification, both prior to NOP and post-NOP. It's nice to have one standard that all certifiers are to, all accredited certifiers are to adhere to. I still notice relatively minor inconsistencies in interpretations between certifiers, but by and large, just having one standard to go to has been a good thing. It's certainly been a good thing in getting more ground converted to organic management to fill the demand that primarily manufacturers have been able now to count on a consistent supply and reciprocity between certifiers, which was a tremendous problem prior to federalization. So I see it overall as a good thing. In large part because it's been successful in getting more land under conscientious organic management.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guests this morning are Ronnie Cummins, director of the Organic Consumers Association, and John Foster, interim director of Oregon Tilth. You can find out about those groups online, back in order, www.organicconsumers.org. and www.tilth.org, and that's T-I-L-T-H The People Rise Up website through KBOO.FM has links to them as well as all sorts of other resources connected to our conversation this morning about changes in the 1990 Organic Foods Production Act. As a rider slipped into the conference committee bill after regular negotiations were completed in late October, and we're just discussing some aspects of those changes, primarily related to the expansion of opportunity for synthetic ingredients to be included in certified organic products. Now, coming back to you, Ronnie, you folks have a tremendously extensive website, web page related to this issue on your site, and I've gone back and forth between your site and the Organic Trade Association site, and they kind of seem to be saying different stuff. I've seen language that says, and I don't know that this is from your site, but I've seen language that says, you know, there's possibility of now up to 500 new synthetic ingredients that could be included. And I see the OTA site saying, and their director quoted in news articles saying, oh, nothing's actually going to change. Well, that immediately led me to go, well, then why did you need the rider if it doesn't change anything? So can you give us your perspective on what might happen with synthetics?
Yes, I mean, the USDA, starting in December of 2002, a mere 2 months after the final standards were put into force, issued a directive which shocked the National Organic Standards Board, our watchdog group, by saying that henceforth the National Organic Standards Board would only be reviewing synthetic ingredients as opposed to the much broader category of synthetic substances. And the National Organic Standards Board vehemently objected to this. The USDA didn't really have a clear response, and things sort of stayed in limbo until this federal court case that you mentioned earlier. So we consulted in June with the chair of first chair of the National Organic Standards Board, Michael Sly, who was the chair when the first synthetic substances were allowed in organics. We also conferred with the then current chair of the National Organic Standards Board, Jim Riddle. Both Jim and Michael concurred, as did others in the organic community, that this legalistic slight rewording of the federal statutes was actually going to have a major impact, in the sense that if the National Organic Standards Board no longer had to review synthetic substances, or at least most of them, this would put the USDA secretary into a position to be able to respond to the hundreds and hundreds of requests from industry for synthetic ingredients. Part of the rider also was giving the USDA so-called emergency power to decide whether organic ingredients were commercially available or not, or whether there was a shortage and that permission could be given to food processors to use non-organic ingredients.
Now, the Organic Trade Association's page overview of the emergency procedures provision says that the emergency provision only applies to organic crops, not synthetic materials. It is limited to the minor ingredients.
Right, ingredients, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but the point is, you have, you should have the National Organic Standards Board, and this is what they've said over and over again, reviewing these requests. We don't want a situation where Walmart steps up to the plate, as they're stepping up as we speak, puts in a gigantic order, for a certain product from an organic company. The company says, oh, well, there's not that large of a quantity of this substance, of this ingredient, to meet your order. I'll call my buddy at the USDA and we'll get this fixed. When we have these temporary shortages of organic ingredients, the National Organic Standards Board, our watchdog, needs to be involved in this decision making. We've seen over and over again the White House appointees behave in a way that's arbitrary and out of sync with the organic tradition. I mean, the fact that their first proposals would have allowed genetic engineering, irradiation, sewage sludge, the fact that as recently as the summer of 2004, they were completely ignoring the NOSB and proposing that previously banned pesticides and hormones and tainted animal feed would be used. The fact that they were saying in the summer of 2004 that they were not going to monitor or police organic label claims on things like body care products, pet food, herbal supplements. I mean, we, the Organic Consumers Association, we had to sue the USDA to force them to say, oh, yes, I guess we will monitor and police organic label claims on body care and herbal supplements and animal feed.
Well, let me bring John back in here for a second. And just to clarify, I want it to be known that the process, the original proposal for the organic rules that you referenced, Ronnie, with the sewer sludge and the irradiation and the GE stuff, that was under Bill Clinton's Department of Agriculture originally up until, January of 2001 when George W. Bush assumed office.
Oh, yeah, it's been bipartisan, the behavior of the USDA in regard to organics.
Okay, but now, so, John, you've worked as a certifier. Any time as a certifier since the new organic rule?
Well, now, when you say certifier, do you mean inspector?
I suppose I do, yes.
Okay. There's a pretty big difference.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is I'm curious if TILF has, say, for example, refused certification of something because of the alleged non-availability of an organic product. I'm curious if that's ever happened. Has it come up?
Oh, it comes up all the time.
Okay, so it's a somewhat common thing. So if the emergency exemption is granted, then it seems like a lot of things that, you know, I can't lay judgment upon people's credibility in terms of when they say, oh, we can't find this organically, we'd love this emergency exemption so we don't have to, you know, destroy this product and can sell it as organic.
Mm-hmm.
So non-availability of organic products does happen all the time. This emergency provision seems like it could facilitate a large upsurge in products sold as organic without that full effort at getting all organic products.
Yeah, well, first off, it doesn't apply to 100% organic products.
Correct.
It does not. No, commercial availability clause has never applied to products making a made-with claim. It only applies to the no more than 5% of non-organic ingredients in a product making an organic claim.
Okay, and the made-with category is that 70% threshold.
Correct. Okay. 70% organic ingredients, and where the principal display panel makes only a made-with organic corn, for example, in tortilla chips, something like that. So this commercial availability clause pertains really to one category of label claims, and then only up to 5% of the product formulation.
Right, and that was the issue in the Harvey lawsuit. It didn't address the 100% or the 70% category. It was really just that 95.
Right. Now let's be clear, because one point of confusion I often see is that there's a migrating understanding and inappropriate bridging between the synthetics issue and the commercial availability issue. So we want to keep those very, very separate. The commercial availability issue has only to do with agricultural, non-organic ingredients in that 5% fraction of an organic product. Synthetics is another. It's a separate thing.
Right. So, synthetics. Now, my understanding is synthetics can include actual ingredients, stuff that's in the product you buy, but it also has to do with, and my understanding is this could be where a lot of the potential expansion would take place, is the issue of cleaning agents and other processing materials. I don't know what, you know, companies do with grains to keep stuff separate, or, I mean, I don't even know.
Okay, well,
yeah.
let me get back to the, because you initially asked me about the commercial availability mm-hmm. thing. And we do come across that often. It is incumbent on the any certifier, not just us, but any accredited certifier, to make sure that there's documentation in place of each operator who is claiming that they can't find enough organic ingredients in that 5% fraction from appropriate sources to show that supply does not meet demand of a usable quality, quantity, or form is what the regulation specifies. So it's not just that, you know, someone calls up and says, oh, we can't find organic cinnamon. We're
right.
just going to use conventional. It's not that easy, or it shouldn't be that easy. That's not how we certify anyway. We do require fairly substantial documentation to show that they've made those attempts and that they need to do that every year. The emergency exemption, at least what we've been informed of from the NOP staff, is that that exemption is meant to respond primarily to the, at least in the last 5 years, the dearth of organic items on a section of the rule that's 205.606, which is where agricultural non-organic ingredients need to be in order to be used in this 5% fraction. The organic community as a whole, certifiers, manufacturers, government regulators, none of them of us have held that line really firmly. And the third point really of the outcome of the Harvey lawsuit was to the First Circuit Court was very clear that we in fact haven't been, we as a community have not been operating in accordance with the regulation, and that we need to do that now. The rider did nothing to change that. So all we're doing now as an industry is beefing up our protocols to get a lot, and I mean hundreds, of non-organic agricultural items on 606 and make them eligible for the claim of a lack of commercial availability. That's what we've been told is the primary utility of that emergency. It doesn't have anything that of the emergency clause that's built into that language now. That doesn't have anything to do, at least from our certifier's perspective, it doesn't have anything to do with the synthetics you reference. Primarily those that you talked about are under a broad category of food contact substances.
Yeah, and we're...
And that's the policy that was referred to in December of 2002. I think there's previous reference made to that. Those are things that the FDA has said occur in such incidental qualities that they almost don't exist. And these are things like sanitizers in some cases. Primarily food contact substances are... Oh, things like resins and adhesives that are used in food packaging, hand sanitizers that food manufacturer, you know, labor might use to sanitize their hands. That's the vast majority of those materials.
And we're going to actually just have to leave it right there. I'm sorry to interrupt you like that, but we're out of time for this segment. You've just been listening to John Foster. He's the interim executive director at Oregon Tilth. You can find out more about them online at www.tilth.org. That's T-I-L-T-H. And we've also been speaking with Ronnie Cummins, the director of the Organic Consumers Association, online at www.organicconsumers.org. Although this legislation has passed, it's going to take regulatory implementation, so that's going to take place during the first half of next year. Check out these folks' websites for more information, and we'll keep people posted on how this is going to be changing. Thank you very much to both of you for being on the program this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
And I'll be back in just a moment here with Joanne Baumgartner and Tim Franklin talking about how farmers, organic farmers and ranchers are promoting biodiversity. Thank you. welcome back to the program. That there was The Cat and the Rooster by Three Leg Torso off their 97 release, self-titled. So you're listening to People Rise Up at 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, USA, online at kboo.fm. My name is Andrew Geller, and we are going to continue our conversation about organic food agriculture, kind of in a broad sense. We're actually going to shift more now to some of the upstream practices, and in specific, talking about how organic farmers and ranchers can move into what is, I think, fairly unstereotypical role as advocates for the conservation, restoration, and preservation of biodiversity. My guests are Joanne Baumgartner. She is the director of the Wild Farm Alliance, which was created by a national group of wildland proponents and ecological farming advocates who share a common concern for the land and its wild and human inhabitants. Welcome to you, Joanne.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we've also got on the phone Tim Franklin. He is the ranch manager for the Yale Creek Ranch down in southern Oregon, and he's going to give us some perspective on what it's like to be a rancher promoting biodiversity. So welcome to you, Tim.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, I want to start out talking for a few minutes here with Joanne. So, Tim, I'm going to just bring you back down, and I'll get back to you in a couple minutes. The Wild Farm Alliance just recently issued a little booklet, about 30 pages or so, called Biodiversity Conservation, an Organic Farmer's Guide. So, Joanne, why don't you tell us what the guide is? It's obviously geared toward organic farmers, so I won't ask who it's for. But what the guide is and why it was created?
Well, the guide was created because the National Organic Program rule requires biodiversity conservation. And the guide goes through about 50 different practices on things that farmers can do to comply with the rule. A few years ago, the major Organic Inspectors Association came to us and said, do you realize that the organic rule actually requires this, and could we help them train inspectors? And so what we did was we put together a committee of organic farmers and certifiers and conservationists and came up with this guide, which you can download from our website. Actually, you can only download the summary, but in a few weeks you'll be able to download the whole guide. But also that committee of experts helped us develop a set of biodiversity inspection questions that then we took to the national guiding body, the National Organic Standards Board, and they amended their model organic inspection form, a form that many certifiers around the country use. They amended that to include biodiversity into the inspection process.
And that was the change this past August?
Yes. Yes, and so the guide is a supporting document for organic farmers to comply with the rule. But it can be used by any farmer. It's just that it does focus in on areas that the organic rule has identified as important.
Okay, and so what are some of the key principles or concepts or practices that a farmer or rancher would do if they wanted to, you know, comply not only with aspects of the National Organic Program related to this, but it sounds like what you're talking about is like a step above and beyond what is mandated. Is that the case?
Well, it is mandated in the rule. The case is that there have always been some farmers that have been doing a really good job, some organic farmers, and some that just didn't know what they were doing wrong or what they could do better. And so this is really a guide that will help bring the whole level of knowledge up in the organic industry. As far as practices, there's everything from farmers can put up bird boxes that attract rodent-eating birds to providing habitat in the form of hedgerows that support predatory insects and pollinators, to restoring riverine habitat that filters and keeps our waters clean. And those riverine habitats also serve as wildlife movement corridors. And on a larger scale, some farmers even are taking out marginal land where they weren't making money, where it was a wetland, and restoring it back to its natural state, which helps with flood protection and groundwater recharge. So, and that's just a few of the many practices farmers are doing.
Okay, well, at this point, let's bring Tim back in here. Tim Franklin is the ranch manager for Yale Creek Ranch, located at the confluence of Yale Creek and the Little Applegate River, down in a part of the state I don't get to enough. You guys have 85 acres of woodlands, pasture, and gardens. You raise grass-fed cattle and sheep. You have eggs. You produce flowers, native perennials for landscaping, fresh vegetables, and you also supply some seed companies. Which is it more? Is it more a farm or a ranch?
Well, I guess acreage-wise, you'd have to say it was more of a ranch. There's more pasture than there is cropland.
Okay, how many cattle and how many sheep do you raise?
We have a small herd of cattle, about 40 head, and we've got, we've run about 22, I guess it's going to be closer to 40 sheep here in the summers, and we have a smaller flock that we keep over the winter.
Okay, so you guys are implementing these practices down on the ranch?
Many of them we are, in fact, yeah.
Tell us about a couple of them. Why don't you talk about one? One of the things that most people who are aware of criticisms of grazing, specifically on public land, would address is the riparian zone, the wet area around streams. So why don't you tell us something that you guys are doing to promote, conserve, or restore biodiversity on the riparian zones of your ranch?
Sure. We have fenced all the streamside areas where we have active pastures, and we limit or exclude livestock access to those areas unless we're using livestock to help control some of the exotic vegetation. Beyond that fencing, in our pasture management paddocks, we have a rotational grazing system where we move livestock. It's in a system that roughly mimics how wildlife or any herd animal kind of moves through the environment, so that they graze and then move on and allow that vegetation to regrow. It maintains good ground cover. It maintains high pasture diversity. It helps build soil in the pasture, so you don't have erosion or any kind of runoff issues that you have to worry about even having a vegetation band of vegetation between the pastures and the streams to protect them from any type of water pollution. But then in those areas that we have fenced along the streams, we're working hard to control introduced species that are very aggressive, like Himalayan blackberry.
Okay, well, that's exactly where I wanted to go next, was say, okay, riparian, next thing would be the invasive species. So how are you dealing with those, and what are they that you have down there?
Well, the two major ones we have, we've got the full suite, I think, like any place that's been farmed for over 100 years. But the big major ones on our ranch are yellow star thistle and the blackberry along the streams. And the way we are working on those is for the blackberries, it's a combination of cutting them back and in some cases grazing them back, and then establishing natives that are competitive. And it'll be a constant there will be a constant maintenance requirement over the course of time, but it'll be manageable, I think, once we get it knocked back a ways. And the yellow star thistle is a combination of irrigation management and grazing management and some mowing that is helping us get a handle on that.
Okay. And now, Joanne, this is this new publication, Biodiversity Conservation on Organic Farmer's Guide. Looking at your folks' website, it seemed like there's somewhat similar but maybe not quite as fully developed other publications in this vein?
Right. We do have some Wild Farm Alliance briefing papers that address these issues in some depth and different, different ideas. We have one on agricultural cropping patterns, one specifically on water, another one on connectivity, another one on cost share and government and other private public support mechanisms farmers can access.
Now, you just used a term that I think a lot of people may have not caught its full meaning, not necessarily being, strong wildlife advocacy observers or researchers. Connectivity. Tell us what you mean by the word connectivity, because it's got a lot of different meanings based on context.
Well, it's a wildlife movement corridor or linkage. So I usually think of it as a river corridor, but it can be one piece of land connected to another piece of land by doesn't have to be a narrow strip. It could be a really wide strip. But there's a connection, and ideally farmers in their watershed work with each other to ensure that those connections are there so that wildlife can move safely through.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guests are Joanne Baumgartner, just there, director of the Wild Farm Alliance. You can find out more about them online at www.wildfarmalliance.org. And Tim Franklin, who is the ranch manager at the Yale Creek Ranch down in southern Oregon along the Little Applegate River. And I don't have a website for them directly, but if you did a search on your favorite search engine in quotes for Yale Creek Ranch, you'll get a couple links. There's one at localharvest.org. And you can also find out about these groups and much more information connected to this issue as well as the topic we covered in the first half of the show at kboo.fm. Go to programs, click Wednesday morning at 10 on People Rise Up, and there you have it. Now, there's many different sections in this booklet here, Joanne. Whole farm diversity, uncultivated area biodiversity, cropland area biodiversity, and then two sections connected to when there's livestock and if you're doing wildcrafting, gathering from nature, mushrooms, or who knows what else. Why would a farmer or rancher, especially if they've got a sizable piece of land, why would they be interested in dealing with promoting biodiversity off their land?
Well, the farm is part of a bigger landscape, and so if you have any kind of crop that needs pollination, there are native wild pollinators moving from wild habitats into your farm, and in some types of crops doing amazing amount of pollination. Overall, pollination is worth $40 billion. Of orchard, row, and pasture business in the U.S. As an example, but there's also other types of species moving through, like barn owls and bats that eat pest rodents for the barn owls and pest insects that the bats eat, and also other insectivorous birds that are moving through. But there's also water coming through your land. It's not like it just magically appears. Well, I guess it could come out from a spring, but in a lot of cases, most cases, water is moving through. And so you, as a farmer, most farmers want to be good stewards. They don't want to have a lot of sediment and any kind of fertilizer runoff from their farm impacting the next farm down below, and or having bad neighbors above them. So there's all these different watershed connections that make the farm part of a bigger ecosystem.
Now, let's bring Tim Franklin, manager of the Yale Creek Ranch, back in here. So, Tim, let's take a little bit of what Joanne was discussing there and see how it relates down on Yale Creek Ranch. Do you guys do any biodiversity conservation promotion off your 85 acres but in the immediately surrounding area?
We do some. We work with other neighbors and local watershed restoration groups, as well as now some of the Natural Resources Conservation Service. We work with them on some of these riparian or streamside restoration projects. Our neighbors above and below us on the river now have recently fenced livestock out of the stream and are doing restoration of native revegetation communities similar to what we're doing. We work with them on water conservation projects as well, and on managing our irrigation withdrawals and our irrigation diversions to conserve to the extent that we can water and keep as much water as we can in the stream. So those are a couple examples.
Do you have any idea what species you are having a positive impact for?
Sure. Yeah, I think we're having a positive impact for lots of species. The ones in the stream here, Little Applegate River and Yale Creek next to our ranch, steelhead and resident cutthroat and rainbow, and of course others like sculpin and lamprey, and just downstream from us is the upstream limit of Chinook and coho salmon. We've got, we live in a mix of pasture and oak woodlands as well as croplands. So oak woodlands are incredibly rich in their biodiversity. We've got an endangered species, Gentner's fritillaria, that we have habitat for that on the ranch, and quite a variety of other species that use oak woodlands. And then just off up in the woods as it grades into more conifer-dominated forests, you have critters like the spotted owl.
Okay. Now, one of the pages here in the new Wild Farm Alliance publication, so this is the section, Biodiversity When Livestock Are Involved, Employing Wildlife-Friendly Management Practices. And another issue, aside from erosion and stream destruction, specifically with cattle and cows, and invasive species, I think a common third assumption related to livestock ranching is ranchers kill potential threats of predators, wolves, for example, cougars, etc., possibly bear, I don't know. Is that anything that you guys ever have to deal with in that part of the state? Predators for your livestock?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we've got plenty of predators here. And
what type?
Well, bears and mountain lions, coyotes, bobcats,
okay.
Skunks,
now,
fox.
In a lot of cases,
pair of golden eagles.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I see a golden eagle like swooping down and taking a lamb or something. But
oh, but they've taken a lot of our chickens.
Oh, okay, sure, right, yeah, right. 85 acres, including chickens. So, not to put you too much on the spot, but you ever kill any of the predators?
No, good. Put us in the spot.
Okay.
Actually.
So, what do you do instead?
We got to get some credit for the amount of feed we've donated to the local wildlife population.
Right, right.
In fact, here's what we do. The main we've got our pastures divided up, as I said. We've got a lot of smaller pocket pastures in close to the barns and outbuildings, areas where we can keep an eye on our livestock, and that ends up being where we concentrate our sheep and chicken flocks. We had them out on the larger pastures farther away from you know, the intense activity around the crops and around the buildings, but we were losing too many chickens to the local golden eagles. So the chickens and the sheep rotate in where we can keep an eye on them, and they both go in at night. The cattle, the herd's large enough where predators tend not to be such a problem, we are out and active in those pastures, irrigating or doing one thing or another enough that our presence tends to help as well, I believe. But there's we haven't had a predator problem with the cattle. There are enough of them, and they're big enough, and we keep them on the move, that they pretty much take care of themselves. So those are some of the strategies we use.
Okay, now, Joanne, this publication is fairly newly out, and it's part of the National Organic Program. Any sense of... Maybe I'm just a slightly bit confused. Do all people pursuing organic certification to show that they are doing this, or is this something that it's like, okay, yeah, you're organically certified, and here's this stuff that you're supposed to be doing and report on once in a while?
Well, every site is different, and the rule requires biodiversity conservation, but obviously some places the biodiversity is just about extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And so farmers are not expected to turn it back into some wildlands, but to do what they can. So, for instance, a farmer in the Central Valley of California, where it in places can be very sterile, is putting in a hedgerow, a native plant hedgerow. But in any case, this guide is just now being sent to all the 9,000 or so organic farmers in the country. And a similar guide has been created specifically for certifiers and is being sent out to all the organic certifiers in the country. So it's really support for farmers to start to address this issue. It's new to a lot of farmers, and the USDA head has said that he's going to be incorporating biodiversity into his trainings he does with certification agencies. So it is in the rule, and it's just a matter of people getting up to speed.
Okay, well, cool. I am going to thank you both very much for joining us this morning to talk a little bit about how organic farmers and ranchers can help promote biodiversity conservation. I have been speaking with Joanne Baumgartner. She's the director of the Wild Farm Alliance. You can find out more about them online at www.wildfarmalliance.org. And we've also been speaking with Tim Random Franklin, the manager down at the Yale Creek Ranch at Yale Creek and Little Applegate River in southern Oregon. Thank you both very much for speaking with us this morning about this.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, take care.
You too.
And you can find out more about them and everything we talked about this morning here on the program at kboo.fm. If you click on programs, go to the schedule, Wednesday morning at 10, People Rise Up brings you to my webpage, which is chock full of all sorts of interesting reading connected to these topics. And the Biodiversity Conservation Guide itself, and I guess they're going to post this online soon, has dozens and dozens of really fascinating internet site web links related to that topic there, talking about farmers and ranchers promoting biodiversity. If you have any comments or questions about anything you heard today or any other day on this program, feel free to send me email, kboo@riseup.net. That's RISEUP.net. You can also send regular paper mail to me here, Andrew Geller, KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I appreciate you listening, And this program will be posted online at radioforall.net. You can do a search for my name and see the entire archive. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you very much for listening to the program today, and whenever you have in the past, feel free to tell other folks you know who might enjoy listening about this online resource. Want to wish everybody a happy and safe New Year, and also let folks know that in the coming year, and possibly as soon as next week, I'm going to be producing a many-part series, at least 15 parts to 18, I'm not entirely sure yet. And what it's going to focus on are the 14 common characteristics throughout time of fascist states. There's been a scientific, politically scientific, examination by a social scientist who came up with a list of 14 common characteristics of all fascist states throughout time, and I am going to do a thorough analysis as to whether or not the United States government portrays and exhibits these behaviors and to what extent they do, examining each one in its own program next year. So do stay tuned for that. We got Democracy Now! Coming up next. But before we go to that, I need to let you know that it is 1 minute before 11 a.m. This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. We're at 91.9 FM out in the Columbia River Gorge and 100.7 up the soggy Willamette Valley. This and every morning online at KBOO.FM. Stay tuned next for Democracy Now!
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.